Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline, couldn't be with us today because she unexpectedly had to play piano for a funeral at her church. So things like that come up, schedules change. However, we have a wonderful guest for you today, and I think you're really going to enjoy this book and enjoy our conversation with Amy Blumenfeld, author of The Cast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Amy Blumenfeld's work has been published in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, Oh, the Oprah Magazine, Prevention, and on the cover of People. She has contributed to two nonfiction books and has been interviewed widely. I'm going to ask a little bit about that. She was born and raised in Queens, New York, holds a bachelor's degree from the Barnard College of Columbia University, and a master's degree from the Columbia University School of Journalism, and she lives in Long Island. The Cast, her first novel, was just released like this month and is the gold winner of the 2018 IPPY Award, the Independent Publisher Book Awards in Popular Fiction. All right, Amy, that's a mouthful.
Thank you very much.
So you're a journalist then?
Yes, by background, I'm a journalist.
By background, yes. You're a journalist. What made you decide to take the leap into writing fiction?
It's a bit of a story.
Oh, good. I like stories.
Well, for years, I thought I would turn my master's project from graduate school, which was about adult survivors of childhood cancer, into a book. At graduation, my professor suggested that I write a book, and I assumed that he just meant some form of nonfiction, like a series of interviews with patients and survivors and their families. And over the years, after graduation, I needed a job. I needed health insurance. I needed a salary. So I got a job as an editor. But on the side, on weekends and whenever I had time, I would sock away chapters here and there. But it never amounted to anything. It never clicked. It never felt right. And then when I turned 40, I was having these conversations with my friends about just sort of, you know, universal things like relationships, parenting issues, religion, things we hope to accomplish, all of those things. And they're really interesting stories, and everybody was sort of at a crossroads. And I thought to myself, why don't I take some of these conversations and issues that my friends and I were discussing and then take those really good nuggets and the messages that I wanted to convey from my master's project. And so I created these characters that were relatable and really interesting, and or I thought they were interesting, and I sort of infused those messages through their stories, their individual stories, and that's how I came to fiction.
So your master's thesis project was on adult survivors of childhood cancer. Is there a particular reason for that?
Well, it's no secret. I had cancer as a child, and I was really interested. Well, to back up, they told us at the beginning of the school year in graduate school to pick a topic for our master's project that would keep our interest going throughout the year. And I was really struggling at the beginning of the year trying to figure out what I wanted to write about. And it just so happened the day before the deadline, true to form, I did not have my topic in time. And the day before the deadline, I had my annual checkup with my doctors at Sloan Kettering Hospital in Manhattan. And I'm sitting in the waiting room, and I have my ID tag around my wrist, and I'm jotting down these different ideas, waiting for my name to be called for the IV room. And the woman sitting next to me does not see the ID tag on my wrist, and she just starts making conversation. She had her 15-year-old daughter sitting next to her, and she was clearly nervous and like a little fidgety, and she just wanted to talk to somebody. So she said, oh, are you waiting for somebody? I said, actually, no. And I pulled up my sleeve, and I showed her the ID bracelet. I said, I'm actually the patient. And she was sort of blown away, not by me, Amy, but by what I represented, which was hope in a future. And so after my appointment, I found her daughter, and I spent the remainder of the day just hanging out with them and talking and answering any questions they had and just chit-chatting. And after that, I walked back home, and I knew that I had my topic because I felt passionate about it. And it was something that I never really thought about, the long-term effects. And the hope and, you know, the issues that childhood cancer survivors face, emotional and physical and all of that. And so I spent the rest of that year interviewing experts, interviewing patients, survivors, their family members. And and like I said, at graduation, my professor said, you know, you really should think about turning this into something larger, like a book. And that's how it all started.
Plays out there for more of a nonfiction approach to this?
Oh, certainly. I actually contributed a chapter, the pediatric perspective, to a book about what friends can do to help people who have cancer. But there's plenty out there, but that's not what my goal was. My goal was to write something that was fun and like a book club read or a beach read, something that I like to read. I wanted it to be a little bit more light, and write something that I would read and pick out of the library. So that's how, you know, I fell on this and came into fiction.
So tell us about the title of the book, The Cast.
The Cast, so the story is about a group of childhood friends who rally around one of their friends. They're in ninth grade, and one of their friends gets sick with cancer. And they know that they are not doctors. They can't cure her. They can't treat her with medicine, but they can make her laugh. And so they make this Saturday Night Live-style videotape called Becca Night Live to cheer her up. And she recovers. She's fine. 25 years later, they reunite over the course of a July 4th weekend in the Berkshires, and they realize that their lives are sort of at a crossroads. And, you know, of course, the weekend does not go according to plan.
Because if it did, there wouldn't be a story.
And then there's no story. It'll be boring. And so the cast is, you know, you can interpret it in different ways. The cast is the cast of characters, that were in the show and that are in this book. And the cast is also a cast can be healing, you know. Like if you break your arm, a cast can help you heal. It keeps you together. It holds you in place and helps you heal.
Mm. Now, in your acknowledgments in the back of the book, you acknowledge the inspiration from 10 families from Hollis Hills who comprised the cast and crew of the original Saturday Night Live style videotape. So does that mean that your friends made something like this for you?
Sort of, yes. It wasn't my own crew of friends, but it was my parents' friends. So there were 10 families, about 40 people from our synagogue community in Queens, who got together in the multipurpose room of the synagogue. There was a bar mitzvah going on upstairs. The caterer was bringing the extra leftovers down to them in the multipurpose room as they spent a whole Sunday filming this. And that's what it was. And so that was just the ultimate in friendship. It was the ultimate in booing somebody who was struggling and keeping them afloat during a hard time. And it wasn't just me. It was my brother. It was my parents. It was my grandparents. They were helping all of us. And so I wanted to somehow pay tribute to that, get the messages from my master's project across, but do it in a way that would appeal to my friends, you know, in those stories and, you know, this demographic of readers who want something light but really thought-provoking.
So how long did you spend writing this book?
Oh, that's a good question. was it in my head for 20 years? Yes. Did I actually write? I mean, like I said, I socked away chapters, but that was for nonfiction. But for the fiction, for the cast, this mm-hmm. actual book, I spent a year writing it, and then I spent a year revising it. And then, the whole publishing process takes a while, too. So that was another year and a half. So I would say all in all, like 3.5 to 4 years.
Wow. Did you have to sort of relive your experience with cancer in order to write this? And how did you deal with that?
A little bit. But it wasn't hard. It's part of my fabric, you know, but also these characters are not, they're truly inspired by, but they have their own lives. I mean, it was really fun. They became my imaginary friends. So I created, you know, that was the very first thing I did in this, was I created these characters and I lifted them a little bit from my own experience, but mostly from just the conversations, like I said, with my friends about, you know, it's not all cancer. It's inspired by it, but this is a book about, you know, relationships. There's a woman in here who is, you know, thought she had everything she ever wanted. She had the white picket fence, the three kids, the minivan, the great, you know, a well-to-do family, the whole thing. And she realizes that she's in sort of a passionless marriage and doesn't know what to do, whether she should stay for her kids or leave for herself. There's another couple in there who, they're modern Orthodox Jews, and they are on the cusp of parenthood at 40, first-time parenthood. They struggled for years with infertility, and one member of the couple feels that they don't want to be as observant as they have been for 25 years, and the other one wants to stay the course. And so, and another couple is faced with a sudden medical crisis, and they're fundamentally at odds about how to handle it, and the clock is ticking, and they have to make a decision. And so, I was really interested in exploring what happens when there's love and respect, and you fundamentally disagree about how to approach something important. And so I was trying to get at that and about authenticity and listening to your gut and not giving up on your gut and knowing who you are, but also respecting the person that you love the most. So I was trying to explore that more than really the cancer stuff, because that's sort of like, that's a springboard, but really it's about all of these other issues, and life issues and relationship issues and friendship issues. And it's all tied together in that. And so, I hope people find it thought-provoking.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, the main couple, or the, you know, Becca, the survivor, is sort of everything that centers around her in a sense. But so you see, and I'm not going to put any spoilers in, but there definitely is a big conflict about, like you said, a fundamental disagreement on a major life issue between her and her husband. That's really obvious, but I didn't really think so much about, but that's really what's happening with all of the couples in the book.
Right. Right. And also motherhood plays a part in it too, for all of them. It's what kind of mother do I want to be? What kind of example do I want to set for my children? And that's another, you know, subtle theme that goes throughout all of it. It's authenticity. It's parenting. It's a lot. It's about relationships. They're all in there.
Now, one thing I found kind of unusual, because there are a number of books out there about a group of childhood friends that had some bonding experience, and now, you know, they're getting together 25 years later, and or 30 or 40 or 20, you know, that's
right.
It's kind of a common theme. But one thing that is unusual is that there was a guy in that group who was not
yes.
a romantic interest for any of his
right.
gal pals in high school.
Right, right. Purely platonic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what inspired you to do that, to put that character in?
You know, I've been very lucky in that I've had a lot of guy friends who were purely platonic, but throughout my life, who really, I don't know, I mean, even when I was sick, I mean, before I was sick too, but especially when I was sick, they came over and, you know, would hang out and just play Monopoly with me. And just, they were the children of my parents' friends and pure, like extended family. And so I didn't want it to just be a girl's book, you know, about these girlfriends. I mean, because guys, you can have really incredible relationships with guys too, you know, and who are supportive in a different way.
Absolutely. And then, of course, another major issue that you're dealing with here is not just the, you know, not just the, what do you say, the after effects of having experienced childhood cancer, but the actual, you know, not just the emotional after effects, but the actual physical issues that you deal
right.
with.
Right. So that was something that it was really fascinating. There are these, it's not just, as you say, the emotional long-term effects, but there are a lot of physical long-term effects because, you know, it's not just moving on after adult onset disease. It's growing up after having radiation to your chest or to your neck or, you know, anywhere, or removing a limb. In childhood, you really have to grow up and live with these long-term effects, and you have to, you know, manage them. And so when I did my master's project, I ended up interviewing Several people who had legitimate long-term effects, and even years into it, they had either a limb removed, or they were dealing with breast cancer, or thyroid cancer, something. And so I ended up choosing breast cancer as a long-term effect for this book, because unfortunately there are so many women in the demographic of readers, you know, that would know somebody if they hadn't had it themselves. Unfortunately, it's so prevalent that, you know, someone knows someone who has been touched by breast cancer. And so I chose that because even if my readers could not relate to the childhood cancer part of it, chances are, unfortunately, they could probably relate to the breast cancer part of it. And the conversation that is between Nolan and Becca in this book is not one that is typically aired. Usually it's glossed over in terms of the reconstruction about, you know, oh, the spouse is so supportive and everything. But, you know, those were real conversations that people were having that weren't necessarily picked up in the media. And so I wanted to sort of address those conversations that, you know, are typically sort of hush-hush, but are important and real.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Amy Blumenfeld, author of The Cast. I want to talk a little bit more about that, because the decision about whether or not to undergo reconstruction is a major turning point for Becca to make that decision. And how common is it for women who have a double mastectomy or even a single mastectomy to forego reconstruction?
I don't have statistics, but it's not nearly as common as going forth with the reconstruction.
And what are some of the reasons that somebody would choose not to? It's hard for me to imagine making that choice.
Why they would choose not to?
Yeah.
From the people I've spoken to, it's about, staying true to feeling comfortable in their own skin. Some people, particularly in this demographic that I've spoken to, is a lot of them were survivors and were just sick and tired of dealing with doctors and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know,
risks involved with the reconstruction.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. There are risks.
See, I think what people don't really
there are certainly
understand.
Benefits.
Yeah.
There are certainly benefits, psychological benefits, and there's no right answer.
Right.
There's no right answer. There's no universal correct way to handle that. But from the people that I spoke to, most of them were survivors of childhood cancer or young adult, which was common. And so if you're in that demographic, you know, a lot of them will say, you know what, I've had enough. I don't want any more. And then there are others who certainly will say, you know what, if this makes me feel normal, quote unquote normal and you know, healthy, then I want it.
Right. Right. That's a tough, I mean, obviously it's a tough situation to be in. And
it's
that's a
very
tough decision to have to make.
At a young age, too.
At a young age. And,
yeah.
You know, we've read about women too who are having preemptive mastectomy,
right? Especially with the BRCA gene.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And how difficult that decision must be.
But I also think it's different for people, like I said, who had been through something before, versus somebody who's doing this for the first time and has never had any experience with any kind of health issue. I mean. It's, you know, it's like anything else in life. Your decisions are based on your prior experiences in
right,
life.
Right. And, you know, when you have survived a life-threatening disease, that probably gives you some insight that other people may not have.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
I one of the other issues that potential side effects has to do with fertility.
Correct.
And you deal with that in the book as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's a common one. And that's something that is not something you always have to deal with. I mean, a lot of people deal with this later when they haven't had a cancer history. Once they're married, unfortunately, they want to start a family and they're having difficulty and that's their first experience with it. But if you're a childhood cancer survivor, there's a decent chance, you know, and you're prepared for this, that there may be some, you know, hiccups down the road and that this may be a reality. And so what do you do if you're a childhood cancer survivor and you're dating and you meet someone you really like? How do you handle that? You know, I had that, that was one of the things that I lifted from my own experience, with my husband. You know, we were very fortunate that we were able to have our own, our biological child, my daughter, but through surrogacy. But, you know, I knew when I met my husband that I was going to have to tell him at some point. So the question is, do you wait until you've fallen in love with somebody and risk losing them? Or do you tell them sort of, you know, right up front and they think you're insane and that you're planning your bridal registry on your second date? So you have to find that like right point, you know, when it makes sense. And then you hope that, you know, it's welcomed and they don't run. And so that's a tricky thing. And that's something a lot of people talk about.
Oh, I bet. I have a dear friend whose son had cancer, had a brain tumor when he was about 5. Mm-hmm. And he survived. But the effects, the long-term effects were pretty obvious to the whole world for him because it affected his growth. And so he was officially a small person. Or a little person. They call them a little person. But he went to Hollywood and became an actor in his late 20s, early 30s. He was on American Horror Story with Jessica Lange in the series The Freak Show season. And, you know, he dealt with this effect really quite well, but it was hard. You know, other people, like there's a segment where he was interviewed on Entertainment Tonight where he talks about this, how people like would treat him as a child, even when he was an adult, because of his size and how challenging that was. And unfortunately, his name's Ben Wolf, and he had a lot of fans. Unfortunately, another effect from the treatment, it caused, I think it was, he started having mini strokes and he ended up dying in his mid-30s.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He kind of stroked out and walked into a car and was killed.
Oh, that's so awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm
it
sorry
is.
To
but,
hear that.
You know, apparently, that treatment that he had had, they later found out it would have caused debilitating effects where he wouldn't have been able to continue living a normal life. But he, you know, he was a very brave young man, and I really admire him.
Oh, that's a sad story.
Yeah, it is. But you had a happy story. So
well, no. Well, that. I mean, that's part of the, you know, that's part of the message is that, you know, fortunately, cure rates are skyrocketing and they're continuing to go up and up. And I, you know, feel very fortunate to be treated at a time when it wasn't, you know, a death sentence. And, you know, not every form is as successful as other forms, but, you know, I feel this need to give back and say thank you. And, you know, I've said this to other people too, given my aptitude in chemistry. There's no way I was going to medical school, but I feel like I can write and I can give back in other ways and raise awareness to, you know, for all of these issues. And so hopefully people will, you know, enjoy it and think about
and
find it thought-provoking.
That's a challenging thing to do, to sort of be teaching but still make it a good read. You know, something that you'd want to read just for the story and not necessarily because you're learning something about
That was the goal. I didn't want to write a heavy cancer book because this is a fun, you know, it's about friends. It's about, you know, relationships, marriages, parenting. It's about all these things that anybody can relate to. And it happens to be that it touches upon this topic. And I'm hoping that people will learn something and find it intriguing.
Wow. So, Amy, would you like to read a little bit from the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
All right.
So this section that I'm going to read is from Nolan's perspective. So this is Becca's husband, and the book is from the perspectives from five different POVs, from five different points of view. So this is when Nolan is sort of realizing that he would like to apologize, and he's sort of having his sort of come to Jesus moment, basically. So here it is. Too wired to sleep, I crept out of bed and retreated to the living room couch. I grabbed a newspaper from the stack in the wicker basket beside the suede sofa and opened up to the Hunt column in the New York Times real estate section. Like addicts, week after week, Becca and I turned excitedly to it to see how people navigated their search for the ideal home. Would a gorgeous facade reveal a total dump? Would prospective buyers jump on a sun-flooded, mint-condition apartment despite the four-floor walk-up and vents that wafted in Chinese takeout from the restaurant downstairs? It didn't make a difference whose quest was featured. It was the process of getting to the finish line that fascinated us. It was a quintessential study in human nature and decision-making. Anyone could dream, but no one got it all. There was always a compromise, a perpetual give and take, and it was interesting to see where and how people drew their lines. About a paragraph into a story about a couple getting priced out of Brooklyn and settling for a more affordable space on the west side, I could no longer concentrate. The apartment was next to our favorite playground, and it reminded me of Emma. I wished my phone were working so I could pull up some of our home movies. Those videos were priceless and always ignited a flutter in my heart, a tear in my eye, or a snort of laughter. Just a couple of minutes could cure any ailment. And then it occurred to me, all this time I'd been searching for an intervention, a purple roadmap from Harold, or restorative nourishment from my mother. But maybe I didn't need any of that. Maybe Holly was right. It was my season to join the cast. I had seen Becca Knight live only once, that 4th of July, in her studio apartment when we had just started dating. My takeaway back then was that it was just a bunch of silly skits performed by some goofball friends who were undoubtedly devoted to and beloved by her. But now I knew the adults those kids had grown into. Now the sight of a pudgy adolescent Seth stuffing his gray sweatshirt with toilet paper rolls for muscles was side-splitting, as was the discovery that he had been one of those kids whose saliva gathered in little pools at the corners of his mouth when he spoke. And watching Lex sing Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun, bedecked in hot pink lace, bangs sprayed several inches above her forehead, was not only entertaining, but enlightening. Her edge and sass were detectable even then. When the novelty of witnessing everyone circa 1990s wore off, I began to see new subtleties. I noticed Jordana sulking in the corner unless she thought she was on camera, in which case she suddenly turned on and lit up with an ersatz grin. I saw Lex clearly take on the role of the upbeat leader, wanting to direct and organize. And then there was Holly, smiling warmly throughout the 90-minute production, her sweetness as palpable as it was now. When Becca shared the video with me in college, I viewed it as a relic from my girlfriend's past. It was touching, but only marginally more meaningful than if she had shown me her childhood soccer trophies or pictures from a junior high school yearbook. But knowing what I knew now, how draining and scary it had been for her friends to deliver that tape to her hospital room, how transformative and indelible the experience of buoying her spirits had been for all of them, I saw that the video was so much more than just a bunch of kids goofing around with a Sony Handycam. I watched the whole thing, including every last handwritten credit that scrolled by. At the very end, someone put the cap on the lens, but neglected to turn off the camera. I could hear the cast shuffle away, and then, once they were out of earshot, the sound of a man's voice became clear. I turned up the volume and felt certain it was Mr. Lefkowitz. "I can't bear to watch them filming down there," he said. "I've cried nearly every day since that child was diagnosed," I heard Mrs. Lefkowitz say. And that's how the video ended. I shut the laptop, placed the DVD cassette and envelope back in the kitchen drawer, and checked on Becca in the bedroom. It was 3 a.m. She was sound asleep. I crawled into bed and spooned against my wife's back. "I love you," I whispered into her hair. Though I'd seen her sleep soundly countless times, in that moment, I was overcome with a profound and unsettling sense of loneliness. I miss my wife desperately. I missed us.
And that was Amy Blumenfeld reading from The Cast. Now, you mentioned that you're writing from five different perspectives. So let's talk about that process a little bit. What made you decide to do it that way, and how did you choose which characters you would write for, as?
Well, I felt the most effective way was to tell it from different people's perspectives, because everyone has sort of a different experience with this, and it can affect people in different ways. So one of them becomes incredibly obsessive compulsive. Another one decides, you know, it's not worth becoming a straight A student, because really at the end of the day, what difference does it make? Another one decides she wants to give up on having, you know, a big career, and she would just rather focus on a family, because really at the end of the day, she feels like that's all that matters. Another one decided to go for the career and make the most of her life as she possibly could, because life is short and why not live out your dreams? So I try to infuse those lessons and those experiences into the different characters as a, almost like their own side effect of having gone through that experience, seeing a friend who was sick at a young age. And so I, in addition to that, I took these arguments, those issues that I wanted to get across, like I mentioned earlier, with the religion and one spouse wanting to continue to be observant, the other one not wanting to, the other dealing with a sudden medical crisis. So I took all of these different arguments, and I grew up in a family of lawyers, so I took a legal pad. And so I know what it is like to love someone and have a good relationship and a respectful relationship, but also you can disagree about things. And I was more on the periphery. I didn't like to argue, and I still don't, but I listened to all of this growing up. And so, you know, there were a lot of these conversations over Sunday brunch. And so what I did for these characters, I took a legal pad and I made a list of their arguments for each one of them. And then from there, that helped sort of flesh out the characters. Why would they take that position? What made them think that way? What in their experience put them in that position to want to argue for that? So that's how I came to all of that. And I felt a first person perspective was more effective in getting that across than just a straight narration.
And why, let's see, I think it's Lex that you did not write from her perspective.
Right.
Why was that?
I had too many characters. I didn't want to overdo it. And I felt that she could be heard through the others. I had to cut one. I needed to have Nolan in there. And I didn't want to have so many so many POVs. So I decided she wasn't as important as some of the others.
You liked her less.
I liked her the least, although I did like her storyline, and I thought it was important, and I felt she could be told through Seth and through some of the other characters, but I didn't know if she really deserved her own voice, an own chapter.
Okay. At what point in the writing process did you come to this, did you know that this was going to be the way that you did it?
Right away.
Okay.
Right away. I knew that this is how I wanted to do it. I mean, I think I may have tried once to do it with a straight narration, and it was falling flat. Mm. And it's, you know, sometimes things just click, and it clicked. And I think I've always liked that first person approach, and I felt that was the strongest way to handle this. It sometimes things flow and sometimes they don't, and it flowed when I tried that.
So it sounds like you knew all the major plot lines before you, like right at the beginning. Is that true?
I knew the issues and I had a blueprint that I mapped out, but it's amazing how these characters take on, and if you talk to other writers, it's the same thing. they become these, like I said, imaginary friends in your head, and they start speaking to you. People would think I'm crazy. I would say, okay, for this chapter, I need to hit points A, B, and C. I would hit point A, and then I would start a dialogue going, and then it totally veered off, and I never made it to B. But somehow in the end, I got to C, but in a totally circuitous way, in a different way than I had expected. So,
but how about the resolutions of the various issues? Although I got to say, you left some pretty open-ended, but
yep. That was on purpose.
But did you know how you were going to, you know, where the story was going to end for each character? Did you know that?
No, I didn't. I knew roughly, I mean, yes, I wasn't blind to it, but I wrote the first draft and I gave it to some readers and they all came back saying, we like this, but the ending is too perfect. It's too predictable. There's like a red perfect bow at the end. And I think it's because you don't want to hurt your characters. You know, like I said, they become your imaginary friends and you don't want to, you can like twist them a little bit and make them suffer a little bit, but you don't want to really hurt them. So when I revised it, I added some more twists and turns. And that's how I got the twist at the end. And I think, you know, part of the point of this book is that life doesn't always go according to plan. And for, you know, hopefully you have some great friends and family around you to support you. But you know, it's not always a perfect ending. And so that's how the twist came.
Was it hard to, you know, did you have to go back when you changed that part? Were there things that you had to go back and change earlier on to make it all make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of layering in there. You have to put a couple of, you know, every word you choose, you know, carefully. Yes, I added little hints here and there, a little, you know, to amp up relationships. And so, yes, I had to go back and tweak.
So, Amy, I want to talk to you a little bit about your career as a journalist. What was your People cover?
So I had been working at it was about children who the children of former U.S. presidents and what it's like to grow up in the White House. And so at the time I had been working on staff at George Magazine. And I had spent a few months interviewing these kids of former U.S. presidents. And we laid out the whole piece and we ended up folding the magazine with that issue. So the editor-in-chief of George at the time, Frank Lally, was lovely. And he set up a meeting with People magazine. And I met with People and they wanted to have me work on it for them. And so I'd been working on it. And then the Bush daughters, Jenna and Barbara Bush, were in a news story and they slapped a picture of them on the cover and linked it to this piece that I just happened to be working on.
Oh.
And so it ended up a cover story in People. And from there, I started freelancing for other places.
Yeah. Wow. My daughter went to UT of Austin, and I think one of the Bush girls was there at the same time. And I lived down there part-time because my kids and grandkids are in the area now. And right down the street, like a block away from my house, is the Chewies, where one of the Bush girls got arrested for underage drinking.
Oh, gosh. Yikes.
Yep.
So, but anyway, they're wonderful now, and they're terrific. And I watch Jenna on the Today Show.
Yeah, I don't think they were any worse than any other kids. Even,
no,
you know,
no, I didn't interview them. I never met them or never spoke to them.
Oh, wow.
But I had interviewed, you know, the grown children of former U.S. presidents.
Oh, right. It says in your bio that you've been interviewed on multiple news networks. So what was that about?
Well, one of them, sometimes I've gone on for fundraisers and things like cancer-related things. But for the Fox News, that was an interesting piece. That was about, this was years ago, with Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, and politicians with cancer, actually. I was fascinated by this and them having to sort of divulge their personal information. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a right to privacy as a private citizen, but if you're running for office and people want to know your health history, whether or not you're going to last in office, not that any of us can predict the future, but, you know, when you have a cancer history, if you have other, you know, medical issues in your past, the public and your voters have a right to know. And so how do you reconcile that right to privacy with, you know, informing your public? And so that's what that was about.
Well, the other thing, as a public figure, you can have a big influence like Betty Ford did, you know, where she was public about her health issues and got a lot of women to go get mammograms.
Right, Right. No, absolutely. You're a role model.
Yes.
So, you know, it can be for good, but it's also you're really putting yourself out there. And so it was an interesting conversation.
I bet. So as I mentioned, there some of the storylines in the cast are a little open-ended. Does that mean there's a sequel on the way?
I would love it. I would love it. You know, I'm plotting it out right now, and we'll see what happens. But I would love to do it.
How about other writing? Are you doing other types of writing? Are you still working as a journalist?
Right now, I'm focusing on the book, and so we just got that out, and now I'm plotting out the sequel.
Oh, great!
But we'll see what happens.
So your goal is to be to write fiction full time?
I don't know. My goal is to, you know, write what moves me, and wherever that goes, you know, whether it's to dabble in fiction, to dabble in nonfiction, we'll see. But I'm open to both. I've enjoyed both.
Now, Becca is also a journalist, right?
Well, broadcast.
Broadcast. Okay.
Yes.
And she also has a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And
you write what you know, but you know, this was, you write what you know, but it's, but
so,
I could,
you know,
and
where
that
I'm
was
going with this. How much like you is Becca?
She is similar, certainly similar. Listen, I mean, it's, you know, I use my life as a springboard for this, but
right.
If I wanted to write a memoir, I would have written a memoir. There was no way that it would be nearly as exciting or dramatic as this book. you know, I attempted it when I was right after graduate school. I was like, this is not something I would want to read. So, you know, I really felt in my gut that there were a lot of messages and lessons that I could lift from my own experience, but I couldn't tell it as my own story, because it honestly, it was not, there wasn't enough drama. Fortunately for me, there was not enough drama. But it wasn't something that would really be intriguing and interesting to the public. And so I took, you know, as I said, my own experiences, and I like put them in a blender with these characters that I felt could address issues that my friends and I were interested in that were not related to my life also. And, you know, and just make it much more appealing that way.
Right, right. Now, Amy, you mentioned that the publishing process takes quite a while, which it obviously does. So tell us a little bit about your route to publication, because you've got, you know, you're published by Spark Press.
Right.
And how did you find them? And
Spark has been fantastic. Spark is a hybrid. So I signed with an agent. We pitched a few the traditional publishing houses. We came very close with two of them. It went to second rounds with them. And then ultimately, the second round of it just, you know, they passed on it. So I could have continued and gone to a few more rounds with others, but a friend of mine and a friend of hers had both published with Spark and had fantastic experiences. And I figured, okay, what do I have to lose? So they're a curated press. It's not, you know, it's not self-publishing in the sense where you just, you know, you pay and they produce it, or you can produce it yourself. It's a curated press, and it's a hybrid. So I sent my manuscript to them. They took a look at it. A couple of weeks later, they got back to me and they said they would love to accept it. And it moved forward from there. And I've been really impressed by their like unique approach to melding the traditional and independent worlds in publishing. And, you know, we really had I was able to put my own two cents instead of, you know, handing my baby of a book over to a big house where I really lost control of it. It was like the best of both worlds. I had the benefits of people who are, you know, seasoned and really been in the publishing industry for years and knew what they were doing, in the traditional publishing world. And then they went over and started this. So that I had their wisdom and expertise, but they also allowed me to be a part of the process, and we were really a team. And so I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed it.
So in terms of how they differ from traditional press, is that more author involvement, would you say?
Yes, it's more author involvement, yeah.
But do they have the editors and the copy editors and...
They do. They have different tracks. So with Spark, I don't know how the other hybrids work, but with Spark, at least, they put, you know, you apply and then they put you on different tracks and, you know, they can either push you ahead or if you need more help with editing, they'll, you know, assign an editor to you. But yes, they have editors on staff who also have worked for years and know exactly what they're doing. It's very professionally run.
And you have the cover is really pretty. I mean,
they did a gorgeous job. Yeah. They did an absolutely gorgeous job.
Who did the cover?
They did. They have they have artists on staff who work for them and design it.
Wow.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And in terms of the marketing, are they involved in that or does that go back where it's up to you?
They are. I have a publicist who they recommended, and I met with her, and she happens to be based here in New York. So I met with her, and she's wonderful, Anne-Marie Neves with Get Red PR. And so I've been working with her, but I'm also working with Crystal at Spark and at BookSparks.
And so they book some interviews for
They
you too,
have
and,
yeah. Anne-Marie has been doing that,
okay.
But Crystal has been incredibly supportive, and she will push out whatever media that we've been doing. Yep.
Oh, cool. Well, it sounds like that's a really good way to go. In I'm just
I have
wondering
no regrets.
If,
I'm
when
very
you say
happy.
A curated press, but it's sort of like so it's a little maybe a little bit easier than getting a contract with the big press, but then if they turn you down, that would feel even worse.
I don't know.
you didn't have that, so you don't know.
Right.
Yeah. And so would you continue, do you think, working with them for your future books?
Very possibly. They've
yeah.
been a pleasure to work with.
Cool. How did you go about finding an agent?
It was blind. I researched, I looked on Publishers Marketplace. I looked, online. I looked up the books that I enjoyed reading and I felt my book would be similar to, and I looked in the acknowledgement sections, and that's always the first place I look when I get a book. I read the acknowledgement page first. And then, I sort of made a list, a chart of names and the types of genres that the different agents represent. And then I picked a few and I pitched and I ended up finding my agent in that process. And I just sent her an email on a Friday morning and she wrote back. It was, you know, and she happened to like my pitch and I sent her the manuscript and she read it and that was that.
Wow, you make it sound so easy.
It wasn't because there were several, you know, like it's just, you put your heart out there and, you know, you're open to getting crushed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You put your heart into a book and you're just exposing yourself, but you never know what'll happen.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Amy Blumenfeld, author of The Cast. Now, one of the big issues that you deal with in the book, although it isn't so much of an issue as just sort of a fact of life, is surrogacy.
Yes.
And Becca's daughter, Emma, was conceived from the egg and sperm of Becca and Nolan, but then was carried by a surrogate mother. And Emma knows about this. And has been told, you know, the story since she was quite small. And I'm assuming that this is something that you really thought about and know a lot about.
That part was lifted, not 100%. It wasn't our experience with our surrogate, but it was just the experience of having a surrogate. It was lifted from our own lives. It was, we had a very positive experience. And, but, you know, if there's one lesson to put out there for people who are looking into surrogacy, it's just, you need to accept that, you know, there's a loss of control. You know, my friends who, anybody who's pregnant, there's a loss of control over your own body when you go through pregnancy. But in some respects, but not in all, you have control over what you eat. You have control over what, you know, if you take cold medicine or not, if you go on a vacation or not, if you're drinking wine or not, if you're taking drugs or not. That's something, you know, I and anybody else who goes through that process as a, you know, the parent doesn't have control over if, you know, if someone else is carrying your child. And so you have to just accept that there is a loss of control. And you hope for the best.
Now, in the cast, you know, Becca, who has a lot in common with you, is married to Nolan, who's not always such a great guy. He has his good side, but there's some issues. How did your husband feel about Nolan?
My husband's amazing. He's a saint. He's completely supportive, and he's been laughing the whole time. He's like, live it up. Have fun with it. So, no, he's been great about it. He's totally great about it. Yeah.
So are there things about Nolan that your husband would look and say, well, that's me?
The only thing, the klutziness.
The what? Klutziness?
Klutziness, yes. You know, tripping and hurting, and, you know. But basically that, you know, like he's for, you know, he's not Nolan. So it's, okay. It was just, I had fun with it.
And you, but yes, the klutz, you know, falling and tripping. You do touch a little bit on the concept of male friendships too. And that's something that I feel could be explored even further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
In perhaps the next book.
Yes. Yep. I would like to possibly focus on Seth, but we'll see what happens. You know, yeah. Who knows? I'll start writing it. We'll take it from there.
So, Amy, when you were, did you keep a journal during your experience with childhood cancer?
No. Yeah. Nope, I didn't.
Have you ever journaled?
I'm not a journaler. I would write, you know, I'm more of a long email to my friend type of person. Mm. But not for myself. No.
Actually, the only time
there was an email back then, but, but no, I was more of just sort of staying the course and maintaining normalcy and not focusing. And when I was a kid, and I think my parents were exactly the same way, which is just, you know, do your homework. Let's, you know, make plans for next weekend, you know, like just you keep the routine going and not focusing on what was going on. And that at the time was what I needed. Mm. And I think what they needed too.
That sounds like good advice.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's no right answer for everybody. Right. You know, everybody has to deal with these things the way that works for them. But what worked for us was just focusing on regular everyday life.
Now, have you ever been part of a writer's group?
No.
Did you have any early readers of your manuscript?
I did, mainly friends and editors.
And did the friends ever look for themselves?
100%, yes. Absolutely. Where am I? Is that for me? Why change that name? You know? Absolutely. And you talk to, you know, any writer and, you know, they show it to their friends and family and everybody has the same experience.
Right, right. Yep. So did you have to change some things?
I, you know, it's funny. One of my best friends asked me yesterday why I changed a name 3 different times. And I just said I didn't want another J letter. You know, there was, but yes, I changed a few things, but mainly just the names. But, I mean, it's not, no one character is one person in my life.
Right,
right. Even Becca. Becca is not me. I mean, my mom read this and she's like, it's really not you. It's, you know, it's your story. I said, I know. I couldn't make it me.
Okay. Well, is Becca's mom much like your mom?
No, it's not my mom. No, I mean, Yes, I was very blessed. I am blessed to have such incredible, loving parents who would do anything for me and for my. And I have a brother who is not in the story. But no, they're different people. They're different people. I would have written a memoir if I felt. I don't know. I needed to change things up and I make it way more interesting. But I as I said earlier, the messages were just burning inside of me, and I felt I needed to get that out. I needed to give birth to this book, to a book that had these important messages, but written in a really more fun way.
Well, I think you totally succeeded at that.
Thank you.
We're almost out of time. Do you have any like closing words of advice for writers?
Keep at it. Mm. Just keep at it. And be authentic and, you know, listen to your gut. If you believe there's a story in there, don't let anybody else tell you there isn't.
Well, thank you, Amy, so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you. This was fun.
And now with the wonders of modern recording technology, we have a quote from Caroline. So do you have any closing words for us today, Mom?
I do. The friendships that we make in our lives. Some endure forever, and these are like the frosting on the cake of life.
Well, thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.